Doing Sunday night tonight on Coast to Coast AM, and thank you always for the invitation to slip on an extra day of the week. A Wizard's Bestiary is the new book out by a guy endorsed by Lauren Coleman, heard frequently on Coast to Coast AM. Oberon Zell Ravenheart has written this compendium, an encyclopedia. It's almost like sort of a combination of that and the Whole Earth catalog, really. It's every single creature that you think may not have ever existed, but possibly has. I don't know if we use the word mythical well in this context, because many of them were thought to be mythical, but then were proven to be real. I don't know if we want to use the word cryptozoological. I think perhaps just the best word for it is exotic. These are the exotic creatures of our imaginations and our legends, but they could be of our lives. Because don't tell me that unicorns aren't real. I'm looking at a picture of Oberon Zell Ravenheart right on the cover with his own unicorn. And we'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Oberon Zell Ravenheart, how do you prefer to be called?
Well, Oberon will do.
Okay. I just check. I didn't know if I had to honor you with your title, you know, whether you're like a grand wizard, or is there a title that comes along with your status?
Well, I'm the headmaster of the Gray School of Wizardry, so when students talk to me, it's headmaster is how I'm addressed. But otherwise,
okay.
Oberon will do just fine.
How many kids are at Hogwarts this year?
Well, at our school, we have presently got just about 1,040 students presently enrolled.
Wow. Is that a full-time school, or is that just like a club?
Oh, it's as full-time as you can get. I guess it's online. You know, it's an online school. So people are all over the world at all times. It's always open because it's worldwide. Students and teachers are communicating with each other constantly, taking classes and engaging in dialogue and teachings and studies.
What kind of classes do you offer online then? Like potions and you know, defense against the dark arts?
Oh, yes. That's one of our most popular departments, is the dark arts department. And the defense against the dark arts is such a popular topic. We have actually a whole club on that.
Yeah. Now, did you start all this before the Harry Potter series?
No. This really was only made possible, I think, by the popularity of the Harry Potter series arousing enough interest to reach a critical mass where something like this could be successful.
Are they broken up into houses like, you know, Gryffindor and Ravenclaw and the whole bit?
Yes, the houses, well, there are youth houses and there are adult lodges. We started off the school in tending it to be for kids, for teenagers, pretty much the same age range as the Harry Potter stories from, say, 11 to 18 was our assumption. We'd be teaching the equivalent of middle school through high school level. But we discovered early on that about three-quarters of the students signing up were adults, some of them clear up into their 70s. We have a total spread of students of all ages. So we ended up having to develop corresponding adult programs and services, and these include the four youth houses are based on the elements, earth, air, fire, and water, and they're called sylphs, undines, gnomes, and salamanders, which are the creatures of those elements. And so we set up four adult lodges to be the equivalent, and these are flames, waters, winds, and stones.
Hmm.
And so, but everybody gets sorted, and
do you have like a magical hat that sorts you?
We have a seeing staff. It's a magical staff we created with a big eyeball in the middle of it and a little poem that goes along. And the poem tells you the lore of the elements and the houses and the symbolism and associations, and finally tells you the one you've been selected for.
Now, what do you, at the end of this, what do you get?
At the end of the studies?
Yeah, at the end, I mean, do you get a high school a diploma? Do you get an equivalent?
Sort of. You get a certificate of journeyman wizard because you'll have completed an apprentice program. It's a 7-year level program. There are 16 departments and 7 levels. These are set up to be the equivalent of what you would get in about a year of study in an ordinary school. But some students move much faster. It's at your own pace. and some take more time, and it doesn't really matter. They can take whatever time they need. But when the seven levels are completed, each level containing about a dozen classes on the average, and you major in one of the different 16 different magical departments, you get a certificate of Journeyman Wizard, and then you'll be ready for the next level of what we are developing, which will be a college-level program, the equivalent of a four-year college-level program of studies, and that will culminate in a certificate of mastery.
And so if you're 70 years old, though, you graduate and you're a junior wizard, do you get any, like, life, you know, skills, extra credit or anything for being 70? And completing the program,
it might take you through some of the stuff a lot faster. And by the time we get our college level program, we may end up with students enrolling in college who didn't go through our apprenticeship program because they have already had equivalent life experience. But quite a few people are coming into this without any real experience in these studies, and so they want to start at the beginning. And for this level, that's kind of what we have to do. It's like if you're coming into a country and you don't know the language, you have to go to school to learn it, you know.
And sure.
That's kind of where we're at here.
Well, and I don't mean to sound flip on this being 70 thing, because I'm pretty sure that the actors that play Harry Potter, Ron and Hermione, turned 70 this year too. I think they're almost 70. Those movies forever. All right, so I'll get to the new book, and I'll talk a little bit about the old book too along the way. But as a wizard, what kind of powers do you have?
Well, I've spent a lifetime developing certain skills and talents, and these include. There's actually quite a lot of stuff that's encompassed in this. There's, you know, psychic and mental abilities, the ability to imagine something and bring it into manifestation, which is...
What have you manifested lately?
Well, lately, the school is a huge thing, of course.
Yes. But, I mean, can you, like, manifest a ham sandwich or something where you think it and you want it and then it'll appear?
Well, not exactly like that, but sometimes it seems almost uncannily close. There have been many things that I have wanted to have or to have in the world in some way, and I have visualized these and done drawings and diagrams out of them, and shortly afterwards they show up somehow or other in an interesting way. I've had things that I've put into my mind really strongly, and then I'll open up some catalog, and there will be just like I envisioned it. But
getting it out of a catalog is that cheating for a wizard, or is that
no? The trick is to make it happen. And but in practical things, I've manifested things for other people. I've helped people to find a home that they really wanted that was exactly what they were looking for. I've done that for myself as well. Of course, it's there's not quite as much work done in wizardry for oneself as there is for others, because it's so much a profession of service.
Mm-hmm.
It's really all about people come to a wizard. They come for teaching. They come for advice. They come for counsel. They come to help you make their life better or turn it around or make it work better or something, and they expect you to be able to do that. And by and large, when you've been doing this long enough, you really do get quite good at that sort of thing. But probably the most spectacular thing that I've manifested was back in the 80s when I brought living unicorns back into the world. That was one of the most enormous feats of magic of my life. But there have been many others. I've done, work with weather working. I've done work with some healings, significant healings. Right now I'm engaged in a work with a lot of people on the healing of my wife from cancer that she
is she still under care, or I mean, how does that work exactly?
Well, she's come an incredible long way in the past 2 years from being completely bedridden and in wheelchair, which was shortly after the diagnosis came. It was just devastating, to where she is presently in 98% remission and doing amazingly well. And the doctors are astonished how well she's doing.
Well, for however she got there, that's great. And I hope that 98 becomes 100.
Well, we're working on it, and we fully expect it to. This kind of work we know how to do, and we have lots and lots of friends. I think probably the most important magic in my life, really, is the enormous number of incredible friends that I've been able to collect in my life around. It's an astonishing thing, you know.
Well, that in itself can be quite a trick in life, and that speaks well of you. Do you ever take money for your wizardry?
Well, it would probably be a good idea. I know many people who actually have who've learned these skills and who set up a shingle and they charge people to come and get counseling. I've never really been able to quite get it together to do that. It just doesn't seem quite right somehow. So the money that I earn is from the royalties on my books and from sales of my art and figurines and jewelry designs and that kind of stuff, you know.
And as a unicorn wrangler.
Oh, yes. Well, okay. We did all right with that. Yes.
Let's talk about that. You brought back unicorns in the 1980s. How did you do that?
Well, that was the present book, The Wizard's Bestiary, is a part of that whole phenomenon. And that was that back in the mid-70s, Morning Glory, my wife and I, were talking with some friends about mythical creatures. We have some really interesting conversations in our family about all kinds of things. And out of this discussion, we got this notion that it would be really fun to write a book on the real true history and background and origins of all kinds of mythical beasties. So we planned to do this, and we set out to start doing research. And over the next several years, in the process of our research, we discovered the secret of the unicorn. We discovered that unicorns, in fact, had been real and had once existed. And as the whole thing unfolded, it became apparent to us that we knew something that nobody had known in hundreds of years, which is how to bring them back.
And,
so
and unicorns, unicorns we thought of as being horses.
Well, the question is, who's we there? Throughout all of history, unicorns were never thought of as being horse-like. If you look at the medieval tapestries, which is probably the most famous imagery, they are definitely not horses. For example, they always have cloven hooves. They have bearded chins. They have little tufted tails. There's really nothing horse-like about them, except that they have kind of four legs and hooves, but they're not horse hooves, you know. What they really look like is sort of a kind of glorified goats, at least the medieval version. But if you go back further in history, you find that unicorns look like various other species of animals, antelope in some times, rams in other times, cattle, bulls in other times, deer in China, in the Orient. The point is that the unicorn is not a species, and that was where we really got the clue from, and that's where everybody had gone wrong. They were expecting some kind of a species. But in fact, we were talking about a phenomenon, a unique phenomenon, like talking about an albino, say, you know. You know, you go out and you say, oh, well, you know, we're going to go out and see if we can search for an albino. An albino what, you know?
Right.
And it's the same kind of thing with the unicorn. A unicorn is a single-horned variant of any type of horned animal. But it has to be produced artificially. It's a process. It's an art form. And that's what makes it so fascinating, which is why, of course, it has been discovered and lost many times throughout history, because it's been a secret. It's been a very closely guarded secret, because such creatures were so mystical and magical and valuable that nobody was going to just sort of, you know, broadcast how they did it kind of thing, you know.
Well, how many unicorns did you end up making?
Let's see. I believe that the total figure altogether was about 9. Yeah.
And did you sell the most of them and just keep one or two?
Well, no, we didn't really sell any of them. We set up a 4-year exhibition and lease contract with the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. But we kept the rights and the actual ownership of all the animals. And that was the first ones were born in 1980. And eventually, you know, they all grew old and had their amazing lives and died. We kept several at home as pets because we just thought they were so neat. They were really amazing animals. And the very last one just died about 2 years ago at the age of 17. And that was the final one. And we haven't really done any more since then, because that was enormously time-consuming part of our life. It was all we did for many years.
Right, right. No, I could totally understand that. Well, it's a beautiful picture then on the back cover of the book. Now, I want to get into the book, but let's wrestle with the title for a second, because I had always been told the word was pronounced bestiary. Yes. I looked it up, and it actually was pronounced bestiary, where the S and the T form the CH sound, and then I heard you say bestiary. So which one are we going to go with for the rest of the night?
Well, the appropriate pronunciation that I've understood has been bestiary, but if you say bestiary, people immediately understand what you're saying.
Right.
So okay. I kind of made that a combination. It's a book of beasts, okay? But yes, I have not heard the bestiary, but that sounds perfectly reasonable. There's always variance of pronunciation from any Middle Ages. It's like different accents in different parts of the country today, you know?
Well, let's stick with the bestiary and let everybody else sort it out later on, okay?
That's fine, sure.
All right. All right, so A Wizard's Bestiary is a very interesting book. Now, you have a wide selection of beasts that you put in the book, some of which, like your unicorn, are real. Others are believed to be real but never been found. Others nobody believes actually are real. And you're pretty clear about which one of those you think aren't really beasts. But what was the criteria for what went into A Wizard's Bestiary?
Well, they all had to be some kind of critters as opposed to peoples. That was a major factor. We left in ones that straddled the line in one direction, such as centaurs and fauns and mermaids and things like that. There were half and half, human and creature, but we didn't include things like giants and cyclops and dwarves and elves and fairies and all kinds of other things. That would be the subject of another book, which we're considering as a eventual sequel or companion. But that was a major thing. They had to be critters, and they had to be critters that were fabulous in the sense of they were the subject of legends and myths and stories, and they were creatures that were considered to be mythical or not, but there's questionable. If they're questionable creatures, you know, they straddle that borderline between the real and the perhaps, maybe, you know.
Right.
And I expect that, many of the creatures in there were once believed to be fabulous and are now accepted as real, an obvious one being the Kraken, which is my personal favorite.
Tell us about the Kraken.
Sure. Well, the Kraken is the reason I think the Kraken is so cool is that there's nothing more monstrous and horrific and unbelievably bizarre than the Kraken. I mean, it's this monstrous creature with tentacles that rises from the depths of the sea and drags down ships and pulls sailors to their doom and all. And it's just terrifying and huge and unimaginable. It's like nothing else you can possibly conceive of, you know. And it was completely regarded as fabulous by the entire scientific community right up until the beginning of the 20th century. And, of course, we now understand such creatures as to be a giant squid. And a year ago, just a year ago, a new species of this was caught, which was much bigger than the previous species that had been understood. The Architeuthis has been somewhat known for most of the last century, although no living specimen had ever been obtained, but many carcasses had been found washed up on beaches and such, and so they were known from that. And parts of them, beaks, had been found inside the bellies of sperm whales, which are their predator, but nobody had a clue about this one. And so when we get back from the break, we can talk about the Mesonychus, the colossal squid, Mesonychatuthis.
You know, I love the fact that you sensed break coming, and I'm sure it was as much the Van Halen in the background as it was your wizard's, you know, keen precognitive ability or something. But that was good. So I like that. Much better than me having to wrestle the microphone back from a guest going into the bottom of the hour. So
well, I've done
thank
this
you.
Before. You're welcome.
Yes, I bet you have. Oberon Zell Ravenheart, A Wizard's Bestiary, coming up in just a minute. And I'll pick that up then on the Kraken. But then also let's push it to the chapter that you have all on things that have washed up on the shore. Okay. And you could talk about all of the various things which have popped up in the form of a carcass or two next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And Our guest tonight, Oberon Zell Ravenheart, who's a co-author of A Wizard's Bestiary. We were just talking before the break about Arthur Tuchus, I can't remember. Anyway, it's the giant squid. We'll get back to that. And the rest of the creatures that have washed up on beaches all over the world, which we may only have one example of. But if we do, it's in this book, and we'll get to that and some other more traditionally considered to be mythical creatures next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Wizard Oberon Zell Ravenheart, headmaster of the, I'm sorry, Oberon, what's the name of the School of Wizardry again?
The Gray School of Wizardry.
Gray School of Wizardry. And a co-author of the book, A Wizard's Bestiary. We've been talking about some of these formerly considered to be mythical beasts like the Kraken, the giant squid. And so we have one that had washed up on the beach, and you were talking about another species too?
Well, right. Just recently, another species that they call the Mesonychotuthis or colossal squid was discovered, and a live specimen was actually caught, the first live specimen ever really caught of a giant squid of any type, about a year ago, February 22nd, actually, last year. And it was much bigger than the giant squid, over twice as big. It would have had, as an adult, this was a fairly young one, only 33 feet long, but an adult would have had a body the size of a city bus, huge, huge creature. Mm. So the Kraken, you know, this monstrous creature of fantasy and imagination that we saw in Pirates of the Caribbean, for instance, turns out to be real, you know? And I think that's wonderful. I really think it's marvelous. So the question is, how many other things are there out there that we don't know yet or that we may have heard about
sure.
or reported that may be real? Or they may turn out to be something different, you know, that we haven't imagined.
Let's talk about some of those things that have washed up on various beaches, too, that is also in your book.
Oh, sure. Well, there's two major categories. There's the curious carcasses of creatures that look like some kind of plesiosaur, but they're always very badly decayed. But they're always reported all the time as, oh, people have found this plesiosaur washed up. Well, a plesiosaur is a prehistoric aquatic reptile from the Cretaceous era, the age of dinosaurs, over 65 million years ago. And they had a body somewhat like a shellless turtle and a long serpentine neck. And they varied. Some of the necks were fairly short, like a giraffe-type proportions, and others were very long, like a long snake-like. And, of course, these have been extinct for millions and millions of years, and there hasn't really been any reason to think that they've continue to survive, and they explain why in here. But there are these mysterious carcasses, and they wash up, and when people study them or look at them or draw them or describe them, they describe this body with these four large flippers and a long tail and a very long neck with a little small skull on the end of it. And it certainly sounds like a plesiosaur, but they're always in such decrepit condition that it's pretty hard to tell much. Very few of these have been preserved. It's amazing how many times people have had a carcass of something right there in front of them, and then they've just lost it, you know, let it wash away in the next tide, you know, or not preserved it or tried to save it. There are many, many of these kind of things in the history. But in this particular case, some of these have been analyzed, and tissue samples have been taken and parts of the remains, and they always, every single time, turn out to be the remains of basking sharks, which is a huge shark. It's the world's largest fish. It's well, right up there with the whale shark. But the particular thing about it is it has enormous jaws and gill structure that are just huge because it eats krill like a whale, like the baleen whale.
Sure.
Do. And when the body dies and rots away, the first thing that drops off and disassociates itself with the rest of the body is these enormous gills and jaws. And that leaves nothing but the neck and the top of the skull. You know, and which is fairly long and with a tiny little skull. And it does look uncannily like that. And I've put diagrams in the book to show how this process works and how the anatomy and the decay goes. And it'll be interesting to see if the next time these things are washed up that people will be on top of what it really is right away. So that's one. Another one are the blobs, these mysterious, amorphous, gelatinous, but tough blobs of stuff that have washed up. They have often have long tentacles attached to them, and people have thought that these are remains of some kind of gigantic octopus. I mean, they're quite huge. They weigh several tons in some cases, and they've washed up on beaches from Florida to Australia, and some places very commonly. They show up quite a few times in certain areas. And there's been lots of controversy about these over the years. I mean, as I say, they've given the most popular interpretation has been that they were some kind of giant octopus, but nobody could ever find any real parts, no eyes or jaw, beaks or organs or anything really, just the general form and shape. And that was what was odd about them. And it turned out finally when they got the chance to be able to do some real tissue studies and DNA studies of these things that they are masses of sperm whale blubber that appear to be the remnants perhaps from whaling. I suspect that a lot of them come from stuff that is discarded in whaling. But
pushed off the deck of the ship.
Right, exactly. And the long tentacle parts are the parts of the blubber that go down between the ribs, and the huge mass is the part that goes over the back of the neck. And I've provided diagrams in there to show how the decay of the blubber of a sperm whale will produce these kinds of images. So we get things out there, and we have to interpret them. There's the canby creatures, these strange little bipedal creatures that have washed up on shores, and they're described as being reddish, and they have 2 feet with flippers and no arms, and, you know, big eyes and a huge mouth and gills, and they weird-looking things. But what these actually turn out to be is a mysterious and large type of fish called an anglerfish that has these 2 enormous side fins that are jointed. They have an elbow to them, and if you were to, you know, hang it up by the jaw, by the head, these side fins would hang down and look like short, stubby feet with flippers on them, you know. So we have this constant thing of trying to interpret what we're seeing. You know, we may really see something, but the interpretation of it has to use a little imagination. It's like the earliest interpretations of dinosaur remains gave rise to all sorts of fantastic creatures, but we're still refining that. The earliest reconstructions that were serious scientific reconstructions of dinosaurs in the 19th century are a far cry from how we understand those same creatures today.
You know, frequently mixing 2 different species together into one skeleton. But let me ask, what does this have to do with wizardry in that sense? How does this inform wizardry to know all of these animals, and then to find out their actual scientific basis?
Well, that goes both ways, you see. A good part of wizardry is what we call lore, the gray wizardry department of it. And that's the stories and the legends and the myths. And these have shaped our culture and how we've interpreted things. For example, I just watched a documentary special on the History Channel the other night with a folklorist named Adrian Meyer, who discussed how many of the mythical creatures described in ancient Greece and attested by remains and bones and skeletons that were exhibited in temples and places were early remains of fossil creatures that had to be interpreted somehow or other. But the stories that gave rise to these and that were justified to explain them, for example, a good one is the Cyclops story. I mean, here you've got, you know, imagine you're in a, you know, some tavern in the Aegean, and the door flings open, and this ragged-looking, shaggy guy, you know, covered with, you know, barnacles, comes staggering in and says, "Oh man, have I had a wild adventure? You know, fill my flagon, and I'll tell you all about it." And you go, "Okay, sure, Odysseus, what happened to you?" You know, and so he tells the story: "Oh, I went to this island, and this monster, you know, with only one eye, that was huge. It was like 20 feet tall, and, you know, it killed my men, and I'm the only one who survived." And he goes on and on with this. And he finally says, "And you can go back to that island and you can find the remains of it. It's, you know, I left the bones of it there, and you can go back and find the skull. And someday somebody does, and by George, there it is. There is the skull of the Cyclops." And what they've got is the skull of a mastodon or a mammoth whose central nasal opening is in the middle of the face and looks for all the world like a gigantic eye in the human skull, because the eye sockets for elephants are on the side, on the zygomatic arch, you know, really inconspicuous as such. But what you've got the proof. There's the evidence, you know. So somebody, so he may have gone there. He may have seen this. He said, oh, boy, I'm going to tell a story about this. And next time people come out here, they'll have my story. But these stories become embedded in our legend, in our lore. They get used as examples. They become anecdotes. They become fables. They become lessons that we teach each other, the story of this stuff and all, you know. And so all of this is interwoven, and I think that science and paleontology and archaeology have neglected the stories to a great extent, often to our detriment, I feel. They've concentrated just on the hard evidence. But the soft evidence of the stories and the tales that people told of things, the histories that they gave, the legends and such, is so much more a part of our culture as humans. And what distinguishes us as humans, really, is that we are storytellers. You know, we create stories to account for everything. We create creation myths, and these shape civilizations and cultures. And if you understand this, you understand that there is an immense power that you have then, and the most incredible power of wizards who know this stuff is that, well, then you can tell your own stories. You can tell new stories, and these stories will shape the future. And the few people who have seized upon this and have used this ability to create new stories that will themselves shape the world have changed everything. I mean, you know, look at the difference that J.R.R. Tolkien made in the world with the Lord of the Rings right. story, or that right. J.K. Rowling is doing with the Harry Potter series. You know, these right. things, they change things for people. They change the way we look at the world, the way we look at each other, the way we understand ourselves. So all that's a part of wizardry.
And I get that. I guess it comes right down to it, though, if we to look at the theme of the various beasts that we've talked about so far from the wizard's bestiary, is that everything is something else.
Yeah.
You know. So are there stories then, either from wizardry or from our own sort of collective history, that where the creature is what we thought it was, where it actually lives up to its billing? And yet turns out to be real.
Well, that's where the Kraken story came in, you see.
Well, but even there, I mean, even there, we don't have, I mean, you have stories, but we don't, you know, we have a squid. But I just mean in terms of like the griffin or any of these other creatures which are ordinarily associated with wizardry, dragons, right. other things, that they actually do turn out to be what it is that we thought they were.
Well, there are some examples of that. For example, obviously, in my particular thing I can touch on very closely is the unicorn story. It turns out right. the actual unicorn is exactly what was imagined. The stories, the histories, the depictions, the descriptions, you know, even the attributes of the unicorns that were given in all these myths and legends are astonishingly accurate. You know, this is considered to be something so fabulous that the very concept of a unicorn was considered to be the impossible dream, you know.
Right.
It represented the imagination itself and a vision of impossible hope and such. And it turned out to be real. When we used to go out into the world with our unicorns in the very beginning of this, we would have the most amazing reactions from people. There were people who would simply fall to their knees with tears streaming down their face. To encounter a living unicorn, you know.
Sure, you know, but even there, like
people talk to me about that.
I look at the cover of your book, though, and I think this is a fair point. But I look at the drawing of the unicorn on the cover, and it's 80% horse. I mean, it looks more like a horse as the sort of the image that we have of unicorn, although it has some goat like features to it. It doesn't look like the goat of the back. Page, and I, to your credit, I mean, I think it's a very interesting point you make about, you know, maybe it wasn't a horse all along. But I mean, what about dragons and what about some of these other things which are the core of what we think of when we talk about mythological beasts? Any hope for them ever being real?
Well, I think so. Certainly the discovery of the gigantic lizards in the Komodo Islands was an amazing thing, and them giving the name dragons was totally appropriate. There are continuing reports from the jungles of Africa in the center of the headwaters of the Congo, which is a vast swamp in the middle of the continent that has been untouched at the dawn of time, really, have continually reported some gigantic creature that has been interpreted various times in history as dinosaurs or dragons or you know, strange long-necked monsters. And the most popular name for this is Makila Mbembe, which is a Congolese name, but there are many other names. Disney even made a fantasy movie about this called Baby, the Lost Secret of the Lost Legend or something like that. This may very well be a real creature. There have been several expeditions there to try to determine this, but it's an almost impossible place to get to. You know, I mean, it's a huge, vast area, and it's just inaccessible. And today, with all the warfare going on in the Congo and all the misery stuff there, I mean, it'd be hard to get an expedition there.
Right.
These creatures have been reported there for a very long time, centuries for sure. And there's examples in Egyptian and other ancient art of... And from Mesopotamia as well, of creatures like the Sirush, you know, that seem to fit that description. There's an account in the Bible, in the apocryphal book of Daniel, that describes such a creature kept in Babylon, and that he killed it, you know, and it was described as a dragon. And you know, there are so many of these stories, and I don't think that they're all fabrications. I think there are too many of them, and they sound too consistent, too reasonable.
Sure.
You know, so I think that there are such things. And then, of course, there's the mysterious ape men, the hairy hominids, the Bigfoot, Sasquatch types of things that are all over the Northern Hemisphere, pretty much.
Right.
And there's a certain consistency of these reports, too. There's hundreds of names among the Canadian Indians, of which Sasquatch is sort of an amalgam of several of these. It's not an actual specific tribal name. It's kind of a generic term. But there are many, many individual ones, and they're very consistent. There are masks and artwork and such are depicting these things that long predate any contact with actual apes. For that matter, the African gorillas, of which we now know
sure.
species, were considered to be entirely mythical in the 19th century.
You know, right. So, what as a wizard? I mean, can you use the power of a unicorn? I mean, short of making people drop down on their knees and cry because they get a chance to see one in their lifetime. But, I mean, is there anything that these creatures do for you or they mean for you as a wizard that helps you in your work?
Well, yes. It's one of those things that's a little bit hard to define clearly. You kind of have to live some of this stuff, I think. But I can try to give you examples. For one thing, for people simply knowing that something that they had considered utterly impossible is real changes the way they consider the impossible. You know, it suddenly means that anything can be possible. And so when you're trying to give people a new vision, a new hope, a new idea of what may be possible, if you can have examples and demonstrations. This is one of the reasons why throughout history wizards have also generally been adept at conjuring illusions, you know, what we call stage magic today, because if you can show people something that they think is impossible, then they will believe that another thing may be. And this other thing may be that they can heal a disease in their bodies or that they can do something that they didn't think they could do before, you know. It's... It changes the attitude that people hold.
Sure. Kind of a paradigm adjuster.
Exactly, exactly.
Yep.
That's a perfect description. It's a paradigm adjuster, and that's a very important thing.
All right. Well, then I want to push that coming up next hour, and I want to dig a little bit deeper into that in terms of your abilities and the way in which you are teaching people to become wizards.
Sure.
What are the wizard traditions that are true, that the wizards that a wizard would actually pass down to another wizard? What can you do that I can't do because you're a wizard and I'm just a muggle? And we'll do that coming up next with Oberon Zell Ravenheart, co-author of A Wizard's Bestiary and more. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Your questions an hour from now on Coast to Coast AM.